key to life.
Hello, this is Sekou Burmese, your host of The Lit Review, a podcast brought to you by the Academy of Management Journal. In this podcast, we delve into the insights of recent research published in the journal and interview authors and corporate leaders to discuss the inspiration for these ideas and how insights from this research can apply to current pressing issues in organizations and markets. In this episode, I speak with Gunita Vasudeva, an associate professor of strategic management and entrepreneurship in the Carlson School of Management at the University of Minnesota. In our conversation today, we talk about a recent paper that she published in AMJ with co-authors Birgul Özlan and Elizabeth Hirsch about how public-private collaboration contributes to the success of socially beneficial innovation tasks. The paper explores the differences between public and private forms of innovation and then outlines many of the obstacles that arise when these two types of organizations work together, mainly coordination and cooperation issues. We discuss the findings from this paper, as well as the implications for efforts around the world that are attempting to solve some of society's most pressing problems, including homelessness, inequity, and global health. I hope that you enjoy this episode of The Lit Review and my discussion with Gunita Vasudeva. My guest today on The Lit Review podcast is Gunita Vasudeva, an associate professor of strategic management and entrepreneurship in the Carlson School of Management at the University of Minnesota. Her research is primarily concerned with how firms create value through their collaboration and innovation strategies. And she studies this in global contexts around emerging technologies, as well as societal grand challenges. Her award-winning research has been published in just about all of our top journals. She's very accomplished. And she also served as an associate editor at AMJ in the group right before me. So in many ways, I am standing on her shoulders as an associate editor at AMJ. Hello, Gunita, and welcome to the Lit Review podcast.
Thank you so much, Sekou. It's really great to be on your show. And you have a great voice. I think you're just perfect for this.
Well, thank you very much. I'll try to keep it up. Drinking a lot of tea. Actually, it's coffee. That helps. So I'd like to start by talking about a recent AMJ paper that you published with some co-authors, and it's titled Public-Private and Private-Private Collaboration as Pathways for Socially Beneficial Innovation, Evidence from Antimicrobial Drug Development Tasks. Now, that is a mouthful, but I love this paper. As soon as I read it, I thought, man, this would be great for the Lit Review. And the primary question that you and your co-authors pose in the paper is to understand if and when these public-private collaborations on socially beneficial innovation perform well as compared to, you know, firms that just do it by themselves or just private kind of collaborations. So before we get into the paper, which I think is really interesting in a really rich context, I want to ask kind of a larger question. So what kind of got you into interested in the topic of public and private collaborations is and a phenomenon that you felt you wanted to understand a little bit better?
So, Sekou, I've worked in international development before I joined the academia. I worked in Washington, D.C. with a variety of international development agencies like the World Bank, the U.S. Agency for International Development, and a number of government agencies. Came from a background where the public sector often played a very important role in addressing developmental challenges, particularly in the context of energy and environmental issues. I hadn't really studied health issues in that setting. But then a few years ago, this was 2019, March of 2019, there was an opportunity to accompany a team of, believe it or not, veterinarians from the University of Minnesota, mm-hmm. and you know a bunch of other experts who were traveling to international development agencies like the World Health Organization and the Food and Agriculture Organization and a couple of other different agencies and the World Trade Organization in Europe as a part of a university delegation that would explore opportunities for collaboration between academia and these international development agencies to address issues pertaining to animal health and human health under the One Health initiative. And my dean chose me, she suggested my name, and then of course I had to go through a vetting process because she knew that I had worked with International Development Agency, so I won't be a complete fish out of water on this team, although I was the only business school faculty in a group of about 20 odd experts from the animal health space.
Got it.
So that's what really, triggered this interest in looking at the role of the public sector in this particular context of antimicrobial resistance, which is what this paper seeks to address. And, you know, looking more specifically at the role of collaboration between public and private sector organizations.
Yeah, that's great. So that's, I think, a great lead into the central phenomenon of your paper, right? So thinking about public and private, public organizations, and I think about universities, but you also mention nonprofits and those sorts of things. They operate much differently than public for-profit organizations or even private, you know, for-profit organizations. But these collaborations can be really useful. They can be beneficial in some instances. So when do you think, based on your knowledge and expertise working, as well as your research, when are these public-private collaborations actually beneficial?
Right. So, you know, one of my observations has been that whenever it comes to a grand challenge, like in this case, antimicrobial resistance or, you know, the well-known 17 Sustainable Development Goals, which are also a form of, you know, grand challenge that the United Nations is trying to address, there's always this emphasis on public-private partnerships or emphasis on the role of the public sector stepping in to solve these societal grand challenges, to address market failure, which is, you know, there is a demand for something, but there isn't enough supply from the private sector for, you know, reasons of lack of incentives or other economic reasons. And for that reason, the public sector is often asked to step in. But I don't think there is very much systematic research on when exactly the public sector's participation can, in fact, address these societal grand challenges effectively relative to not just, you know, solo development by companies, for instance, you know. So there is some research which has looked at, are companies better off getting, you know, funding from the public sector? Are companies better off collaborating with the public sector? Of course they are. But there isn't really a lot of systematic work comparing the effectiveness or the efficiency of these collaborations relative to private-private collaboration. So that's, you know, where I wanted to make a contribution. And also, I think what really strikes me as interesting is that, you know, when you go to these agencies, there's very little discussion even of the role of the private sector. So coming from the business school, I was really struck at how little people even think about the role of companies in addressing societal grand challenges.
So do you have an example? This also seems really interesting, but so maybe this is from the experience you had with the One Health initiative that you mentioned. So are these agencies, and they're not even thinking about healthcare companies or private companies and the ways that these private companies can actually help?
Absolutely. I mean, so I did notice that there were, you know, senior executives from private pharmaceutical companies who now work at the World Health Organization, for instance, who were making these presentations. And one would expect that these people, having worked at the private sector in that domain, they would be very aware of the role of the private sector and so on. But I didn't see any, you know, direct inclusion of the private sector or any kind of attention being given to the role of the private sector, at least in this space. And there was a lot of discussion of, you know, antimicrobial resistance from the standpoint of, you know, how there is an overuse of antibiotics, which leads to this problem of resistance, like an arms race between the bacteria and the antibiotics. But also how this problem of antimicrobial resistance is perpetuated because of, you know, lack of regulatory standards in countries that are producing a lot of antibiotics, and these effluents are getting into the water systems and then indirectly getting into humans and animals, and then directly perpetuating the problem of antibiotics. So you're just consuming antibiotics through the water or through the food, even though you don't really need it. And then when you actually need it, you're not really responding to it. And, you know, certainly companies are playing a very big role in this, both in a positive way and a negative way, but you don't really see much of that being directly acknowledged or examined. And it's almost like, you know, the public sector does all of it. Yeah. And they do it all by myself, all by themselves, which is, I don't think, you know, accurate.
All right. So thinking about the public-private collaborations, there's times where it's necessary, right? Like you said, when there's not really great incentives for private investment, but there's a big need for society. So there's, you know, a good opportunities. But there are also times when it wouldn't work well, right? Where you can imagine that World Health Organization brings in pharma and a pharma company and an agency are trying to work together and it's not working well, right? And I think even in your paper, you talk about the development of the COVID vaccines and how there were some bumps along the road with that collaboration.
Right. So, you know, we give some concrete examples in the paper also with respect to the AstraZeneca and Oxford partnership and then Merck's involvement in vaccine development under the Operation Warp Speed, which was launched by the U.S. government. And so, you know, it's not to say that, you know, public-private collaboration doesn't work, but there are problems of incentive misalignments, which can lead to problems of cooperation, as we point out. And a lot of the research, I think, that has looked at collaboration risk has looked at mostly these incentive problems. You know, the transaction cost perspective has mostly looked at these incentive problems leading to cooperation failures. But what we also bring into the study is problems of coordination, which is what generally organization theorists have looked at. And, you know, our study cites some of those, you know, very crucial papers for our study that have, you know, distinguished between cooperation and coordination problems. And I think it's important to bring those together. And so what we are finding is that both problems of cooperation and coordination can become more tenuous in public-private collaboration because, like I said earlier, the problems of incentive misalignments, the, you know, public sector cares more about social welfare, just to kind of keep things, you know, simple, and the private sector cares more about profits and, you know, reducing uncertainty. So that's kind of one very kind of, you know, simplified way of thinking about incentive misalignment. But then there are also problems of coordination in terms of, you know, you have very different organizations, very different organizational setup, which are trying to come together to work on these very complex drug development tasks, for instance. And that creates, you know, these operational risks in addition to the relational risks that arise from the incentive problem. So what we find is that public-private collaboration can work well, especially in the discovery stage when there is a lot of uncertainty or when there is, you know, new drug development, again, when there is a lot of technological uncertainty. But it doesn't work very well, you know, when you're getting closer to the commercialization stages where, you know, the incentive misalignment problems become more pronounced and so on. So there are conditions under which the public-private collaboration could actually be effective and efficient versus the private-private collaborations.
Yeah, and I think that's a really interesting kind of finding, which is in the life cycle of kind of a collaboration. It's the beginning, right, where you're trying to figure out what a solution might be. And then towards the end, it's about executing and then maybe rolling out this solution. And it sounds like at the beginning, hey, these public-private collaborations kind of work really well, right? Because now it's about, hey, bringing different viewpoints to bear might give you interesting ideas. But as you get closer to the, all right, now, how's this going to work? And how much is it going to cost? And who's getting money where? That's where things start to fall apart, so to speak. Well, not fall apart, but you start to have more friction. So that was, I think, one of the key findings. Was there anything unexpected that you learned or that you found in this paper? Either something that was in the paper or maybe something that didn't even make it into the paper, but that surprised you?
Yeah, so I'd say, you know, the one thing that surprised us was that, you know, we theorized both in terms of cooperation and coordination problems being important, and we were trying to capture the cooperation problems based on the effectiveness, that is whether the task even moves from one stage to the next stage. So both cooperation and coordination challenges can deter a task from progressing, right? Because if things are delayed, if there are disagreements, if there are coordination problems, that can have an effect on both. But when it comes to the time that it takes for moving from one task to another, which is what we call efficiency, which is also, you know, what is generally regarded as efficiency in this literature, that is more related to the coordination challenges. So if there are lots of coordination challenges, you might actually take longer to achieve a particular goal. So you may still make progress, but it might just take you longer. And that's the problem of efficiency, right? And that's like, that happens if there are coordination problems. So what we found was that, in fact, you're seeing quite a bit of, you know, significant difference when it comes to effectiveness between public-private and private-private, but you're not really seeing a lot of significant difference when it comes to the efficiency of public-private and private-private in terms of the time that it takes, except for in the clinical stages. And so what that tells us is that coordination problems are perhaps less of a problem. They are, you know, maybe more tractable. Like, you know, those are things that could be more easily overcome. You could actually put in place governance procedures. And so there is an opportunity to, you know, address those types of coordination problems. But the cooperation problems, which are coming from inherent incentive misalignments, those are much harder to change. So, you know, I can't change the fact that as a company, you have a profit motivation, right? And I, as a government agency, have less of a profit motivation and more of a public goods type of motivation. That's harder to change. And so I think that was kind of interesting and revealing for us and deserving some maybe future investigation and how contracts can.
And speaking of contracts, so one thing that was kind of buried at the end of your paper, but kind of raised an eyebrow, and it was about the nature, like the nature of the contracts here. And I'll read from here. You say that the qualitative analysis, you found that there was a lack of provisions in the contracts. And for the public and private collaboration, only 22% of them in the sample had milestones, developmental milestones. Hey, here's where we're going to go at this point, compared to over 70% of the private-private collaborations, right? And you think, all right, we're doing this really important stuff, and yet there seems to be a lack of specificity in these contracts. So is this like is this a contracting story, right? Is a lot of what you're saying is like, hey, the contracts to govern, you know, governmental agencies and, you know, private companies, we have to get better at that. And if we can get better at that, man, we can really tackle some of these gnarly grand challenges. So I was struck by that the fact that there's so little of it in the public-private. So did you have any conversations with people or, you know, your own experience? Is there a reason why there's a lack of this specificity around milestones in the public-private space?
Right. So, you know, the reason we dove into contracts and that kind of came a little bit later in the paper is because the reviewers were asking us to provide them with more and more evidence on these differences in cooperation and coordination problems. And so we were just wondering.
Reviewers always do that. They always want more. Reviewers always want more.
In a way, I'm thankful to the reviewers because they really kind of pushed us into investigating this, you know, this knowledge base. It opened up this opportunity, this world of contracts, which we had not even really thought about initially. We had done some interviews with experts, and we used that qualitative evidence as well to both build our theory and to validate our results. But this world of contracting really kind of was something that we were pushed to look into because, you know, we were being asked to provide more evidence on whether there is, in fact, you know, a systematic difference between the public-private and the private-private collaboration. And how could we unpack that black box, right? Like, how do we go into that black box and say, yes, there are, in fact, these systematic differences in how, you know, problems of cooperation or how incentive alignment issues are being tackled, or how governance is being tackled, in these different types of collaborative arrangements. And so we thought the contracts might give us some clues for that. And so that's how we kind of went into the contracts, and based on whatever contracts we could get our hands on, it was a smaller sample of, I think, about 176 contracts. Yep. We did, just a very simple text analysis. We did just reading of contracts to pick up on, excerpts which seemed to address some of these issues. And then we also did a little bit more systematic analysis to present, differences across the different dimensions of, how relational risk was being addressed in these contracts versus operational risk. And I think, what we were finding in these contracts was also corroborated by what we heard from experts. So one of our experts who had worked extensively both on the public sector side and, on the private sector side, there's this nice quote about how these projects, when they're sponsored by public agencies, become zombies that are hard to kill. So that is kind of very much in line with this idea that, once there is a project that has been sponsored, that has been launched by the public sector, by the government, then there isn't really a lot of provision for saying, okay, we're going to do these milestone checks, and if it's not making it, then have those go no go type of provisions. So I think simple go no go type of provisions can really change the time, the effort, all of that can really reduce the costs that you're investing in projects that might otherwise not be viable.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it sounds like there's a big opportunity to improve the performance of these kind of collaborations with an eye towards these, very simple kind of improvements to contracts, right? So adding them in, adding in, when are we going to stop doing this? When do we kill this zombie? Might be also kind of useful and fruitful so that a new collaboration maybe can take its place, right? So expanding out a little bit, one of the other things that I love about the paper is it's about public-private collaborations, but it's about something that's really important, right? Thinking about health, and you've talked a little bit about that. But I think the larger question is, this is kind of the way that most grand challenges are being attacked, right? It's through government and private companies trying to get together and solve things like around poverty and health and hunger, infrastructure, economic growth, and the like. So what are some of the takeaways that you think are generalizable to these other kind of grand challenges? Because I think there's probably people who in some way or another are working on trying to improve this, and it's some sort of a collaboration between government or public organizations and private organizations.
I think, the role of the public and private sector are very core and crucial to addressing several of the grand challenges, whether it's, health related, water related, energy related. I mean, so, I think some of these approaches of public-private collaboration are being used quite commonly across these different 17 SDGs. And I was just looking at it this morning, and what struck me was that if you go into any of those SDGs on the UN's website, just click on any of those squares, you'll see a lot of information on those SDGs in terms of targets and tasks and activities and whatnot. And then they will have, the section on multi-stakeholder engagements and conferences and things like that.
Yeah.
But they never really give any specificity on, to what extent are there public-private collaborative arrangements, to what extent is the private sector, how much investment is coming from the private sector to address. I'm sure there is, there is investment coming from the private sector to address, water-related challenges, for instance.
Yeah.
I know coming from India, companies like Coke, Coca-Cola were investing heavily in watershed management, for instance, right? Because that's the foundation. That's a very critical resource for their sustainability, economic sustainability. So I know that, you know, companies are doing a lot of work in each of these areas, but there isn't really any explicit documentation or tracking, you know, in terms of contributions, in terms of outcomes. So I would really hope that, you know, organizations like the United Nations, who have access to the data, who have the influence, can, you know, start doing better documentation. And I think that will lead to more potential studies that can, you know, look at what we're looking at in the context of the healthcare sector, maybe, you know, expand it to other sectors like water or energy and others, and see, you know, to what extent these findings are replicable, or, you know, to what extent there are boundary conditions. And I think that would be really interesting to look at.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, part of the reason I am an org theorist is that it occurred to me pretty early on that just about every really important thing in my life was the result of some organization, right? An organization helped bring me into this world. My mom went to a hospital, right? So there's a hospital, you know, then I went to school and then I got a job. And so for all of these really important issues of our day, climate change and the like, making progress is important. And that's really going to be based on how strong the organizations are that are trying to approach this. And so I would love more attention and research like what you've been doing to be done, so that we can perfect what should those organizations look like that are addressing this. And if we can fine tune those, then maybe we can make a lot more progress on these sustainable development goals than we've been doing. Right. So that's our role in this thing. I'm not a biologist. I'm not a medical doctor, but hey, you guys are all in organizations and I know organizations. So maybe we can help in that way.
Yeah.
All right. So I want to finish this off with two kind of fun questions that I like to ask all my guests. The first, much of research that I read and when I talk to people, it's driven by curiosity, right? That you see something, a trend, a pattern going on in the world that you don't quite understand. And so what right now is piquing your curiosity? It can be anything related to what we see in society within organizations or markets.
So right now, you know, I'm very interested in issues around data privacy and data security. So I'm, you know, again, I think this might seem a little bit different from what I've been doing in this paper, for instance, but I do think that issues around data privacy and data security also have societal impacts, just like, you know, antimicrobial resistance might have societal impacts, or climate change might have societal impacts, which is also a topic that I'm studying, looking at electric vehicles commercialization across the world. But I'm very intrigued by, you know, the implications of data privacy and how different societal actors, government actors, private sector actors are going to be playing a role in this area, and how it's going to be impacting them. So, you know, the GDPR is one such example of how governments are getting involved in creating this public good, the societal, you know, benefit of data privacy, data security, and how, you know, the private sector is stepping in. And, you know, I think that's an interesting area of research for me, also something that I'm, you know, tracking and kind of, you know, keeping my eyes peeled for. So, yeah, so I think that's one
data
issue,
privacy.
Which is, and data privacy. And also I'm kind of very struck with, you know, how these issues around data privacy and data security are affecting the fortunes of, you know, these very large established companies like, you know, Meta that has been rebranded from Facebook, or, you know, other companies like Amazon that is being targeted by regulators, you know, the US. So it's just very fascinating to see how data is becoming the new oil, so to speak, and it's becoming a source of great value creation and competition. And it has gained some of the same elements in terms of this conflict, but also potential for cooperation between public and private entities.
Yeah, I remember reading an article probably a couple of months ago about what would happen if people were given the ability to personally benefit from their data, right? So right now, I use a phone, I click the consent, they can get whatever they want. But if we set something up where companies had to actually reimburse me to, you know, track what I look at in Instagram, and if there was a way to actually kind of do that and allow people to choose to or not choose to sell their own data, which right now they're kind of giving away. Yeah. Would that be good, bad? You know, how would that change a lot of what we have right now? And I thought it was a cool thought experiment.
Oh,
do I think it's going to happen? I don't know. But definitely a thought experiment. I could see it happening.
Absolutely. And I think there are institutional differences. So there's some work in the legal space and the law journals that has looked at how data and innovation more broadly is kind of defined by this notion of permissionless innovation in the US, where you just go and do things and ask for,
forgiveness.
Yeah. You don't ask for permission. But in Europe, this whole regulation around GDPR and data protection is based on the principles of human rights. Mm. Yeah, that individuals have these rights, and you can't really violate those rights by misusing their data. But there's also, these issues in terms of alienability of data from the individual. And, so there are issues around the legality of it and issues around the ethics of it. So it's not, I think, a straightforward issue, because something that might appear unethical may actually be legal.
Yeah,
that's true. So those are.
Yeah, that's a whole nother topic. Legal is ethical. What's ethical is legal.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Second question, and I'll take us out on this one. What is something that you are reading right now for fun? Just for fun. You're not an AE anymore, so you don't have to write decision letters. So you have all this spare time. What are you reading for pure enjoyment?
Oh, I just started a subscription to The New Yorker, and I really love their crossword puzzles.
Okay.
So I was kind of, very taken in by the crossword puzzle, because I was able to do the first one completely, and then I tried doing the others, and I wasn't able to do that very well.
The first one they give you is always the easiest one. Yeah, they want to get you hooked.
They probably started me out. Yeah, they probably started me out on the easiest one, the first magazine that I got. That was, a couple months ago. But doing the crossword puzzles have been really fun. And but I've also been kind of doing some reading here and there. I teach innovation classes, so I, try to kind of keep up with my, knowledge around innovation topics. So one of the books that I've been enjoying reading, haven't completed it, is Walter Isaacson's biography of Jennifer Doudna's work, related to the RNA technology and CRISPR and, all of that, which has kind of been also very related to the COVID vaccine development.
This is we're way off base. I said for fun. That sounds like I'm reading to prep for class. What are you reading for fun?
Yeah.
Are you reading articles in The New Yorker? Do you read articles in The New Yorker, or you just do the crossword puzzle?
There have been some articles in The New Yorker that have been quite interesting too. So I think I was reading articles around issues of, how DEI issues, for instance, are being, perceived, and gender issues. I think we have so much conversation going on around DEI and gender. And I think New Yorker has been doing some fun coverage on those topics. And what I like about The New Yorker is that, they always have a very humorous take on serious topics. Their writing style has catchy titles, like they have funny titles, but The New Yorker, the whole writing style is kind of, they bring comic relief to very serious topics.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you, as a New Yorker, that is very typical of The New Yorker, which is, we're going to tell you, but we're going to tell it to you with a little sarcasm, because, everything's good with a little sarcasm on there.
Yeah, I mean, it's, that kind of lightens things up a little bit.
Oh, that's good. All right. That's for fun. All right. That other thing you were going down, about innovation. No, that wasn't fun.
Yeah, that's heavy reading.
That's work. That's work. And I know you love your work, but no, that's not what I was asking. But I wanted to thank you. I appreciate you for taking the time out to speak to me. And thank you for all the work you put in on this project and this paper. And like you were saying, I hope that there's other opportunities for you to dive into some of these additional questions, and hope to see you around sometime at an AMJ get together, maybe this summer.
Same here, Sekou. It was a real pleasure speaking to you, and thank you for this very engaging conversation. I just don't know where the time went. I really appreciate what you're doing for the community. So thank you so much.
It was great collaborating with you. All right, that's it for the Lit Review. I appreciate Granita for her time, and I appreciate you all for listening. If you liked this episode, please subscribe to the Lit Review podcast. You can find us by searching The Lit Review, an AMJ podcast, on iTunes, Spotify, or any other podcast platform that you use, as well as on the AMJ homepage. You can also find us on Twitter, also known as X, where we have a weekly spaces show called AMJ Radio Live that's hosted by @AOMConnect. Thanks to the Academy of Management for their support for this podcast. Special thanks to my producer, Holly Fearing, for all of her work that she does behind the scenes. Our theme music is produced by Key to Life. This is Sekou Burmese. See you next time. Take care and be good. Key to Life.